Hi, I'm Fabi Fav.
And this is Babelito.
And we are Latinos Who Lunch, the podcast where we talk about important things like
Mexican-born queer Chicanos.
Hey!
Hello, hello, hello.
Que show, que show, que show.
How are you, Babelito?
I am excited to be in the same room with you for once.
I know, we usually record the podcast in different cities. But we also have the honor, I'm just going to get right to
it. Go for it.
We're in Alma Lopez's studio in Los Angeles. Thank you for having
welcome.
Us in your studio.
You are welcome. I'm so excited to meet Latinos Who Lunch.
This is us in the flesh. What do you think?
Yummy, yummy, yummy.
I gotta confess, I've been teaching your art for 7 years in my classes. So as soon as you opened the door, my stomach just dropped.
Oh my gosh.
So we're very honored. You're a very important figure for all of us. So I'm just gonna get it out of the way. Thank you for that. And now we can get into it.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard about your work for a long time now, and I just want to get a few things out of the way too. I told some people that I was coming to visit you, and they were so excited. So saludos de Tay from the National Hispanic Cultural Center.
Oh my God, I love her. Because she's one of my favorite people in the world.
Yeah, because I know that she was the director. Well, we'll get into the controversy later, but she was a big part of that. And then saludos de our friend Juan Fernandez in Oakland. He says hello.
Oh, he's a cutie pie. I love him too.
Know. And then our friend Doctora Irene Mata sends her saludos. She teaches Chicano studies at Wellesley College in Massachusetts.
Awesome. Saludos from everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is so exciting. So let's talk a little bit about how this meeting actually happened.
Wait, let's talk about food first.
Okay. So I have to confess something. I saw in your stove that you have albóndigas. I want to know that recipe.
Oh, we'll have to ask my spouse.
Oh, okay.
The writer, Alicia Gaspar de Alba. She's the albóndiga maker in the house.
Oh, so, but how are her albóndigas?
They're absolutely delicious.
That's so...
Wow. Oh, my God. I should have, asked you guys if you wanted some. I didn't know you were snooping around my kitchen.
Well, Babelito is known for snooping around people's kitchens, so that's on brand for him. But I saw a video of you online making agua de Jamaica.
Mm, yeah.
Is that true? Let's talk about it. Let's get into your recipe.
Okay, so agua de Jamaica is the drink, my signature drink. And, I'm from Mexico, so of course, aguas frescas are our thing. So the way that I make agua de Jamaica is I try to get the freshest Jamaica leaves or flowers, right? And believe it or not, here, where we live, the closest and best place is Smart and Final.
Mm,
incredible.
Wow. Or as my mom calls it, La Fina.
Oh, see?
Voy a La Fina. I'm like, okay, girl.
Yeah. So, I just boil some water. And then I just throw a couple of bunches, and I let it boil for a little bit. Uh-huh. And then I fill up a big jarro, mm-hmm. of glass jarro of ice, and I throw a bunch of sugar on it, usually brown sugar. Sometimes if we have no sugar, then it's, agave. And then just dump the hot Jamaica on it. And that's it.
Wow.
And then stir, of course, try to get the sugar all mixed in there. And so then that could be mixed with all kinds of things, right? With a little bit of soda, bubbly, Perrier.
Como type. Agua de, ¿cómo se llama? Agua mineral.
Agua mineral, with a little agua. Or just like that, So usually for parties, which we have, every once in a while here, that's the drink that we have.
Yeah, and Alma has an incredible home. We are right now in her studio, and it's filled with art pieces. And you told us that you just moved over here, right?
Yeah, just in 2015, mm-hmm. we moved here. We were living in a small apartment near LAX, mm-hmm. and we just needed a bigger space because we wanted to adopt a baby. And fortunately, on November 30th, it was official. We adopted a little girl named Azul.
Yay, Azul. Yeah. Congratulations. Yeah,
she's 2.5. And then before then, we had already adopted two kitties, Ruby and Luna, and then two doggies, Penelope and Lucy.
Full house.
That's a full house, yeah.
You are from Los Mochis, Sinaloa, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what are the foods of Los Mochis growing up that you either where do you go to find them here, or you miss still from growing up over there?
Well, the big thing in Los Mochis, you know, and in Sinaloa, because it's in the northwest mm-hmm. of Mexico, mm-hmm. right, is ceviche.
Yes.
And so, you know, fresh ceviche, that's sometimes you miss that a lot because there's shrimp ceviche, different kinds of fish ceviches.
What chiles are from the north?
The fresh chiles, more like the pico, that kind of thing. Uh-huh. The pico de gallo. Mm-hmm. So definitely, there are some places in East LA that have like little puestos that have fresh ceviche, like across from Estrada Courts, you know, where like, all those murals, uh-huh, famous mm-hmm. murals are. There's a little place. I can't remember the name of it, but it's a really delicious little place that has good ceviche. And then the other thing are, you know, the
tortillas de harina.
The tortillas de harina, of course. Yes. You know?
My family lives in Hermosillo, some of my family uh-huh. in Sonora, and they're like all about the tortillas, all about machaca. You know? Oh, my God.
Machaca with huevo.
With huevo.
Yeah. And a tortilla de harina.
Oh, and everything yummy. Cooked over a wood fire. Like, they love to cook over wood fire in Sonora. It's amazing.
Machaca is dried meat mixed with huevos, chile, tomate, cebolla, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or, okay.
Mm-hmm. But they're also close to they're pretty close to the ocean, too, which is pretty cool. And, yeah, I've had some amazing ceviche there, too.
Yeah. The other thing is the buñuelos. Like Oof. Around Christmas time. So I remember my aunts doing a whole line for making the buñuelos. First making the tortilla. Mm-hmm. They would make these huge flour tortillas that were seriously like, I don't know, like...
yeah, those tortillas are 16
famous. Inch yeah. in diameter.
They're like 2 feet.
Big tortillas, but really thin. And then they would throw them on the comal with wood fire, you know, throw them on the comal. And then, and the comal was basically like a big piece of tin, like this table.
Mm-hmm.
And throw them on the comal, flip them. I don't know how they didn't burn their fingers, because it's not like they use tongs, like, you know.
Yeah.
and then throw them into, like, to fry them.
Right.
And then sprinkle them with sugar or
canela.
Or they would make this really yummy sauce with, like, it was like canela, sugar.
Piloncillo, yeah.
Yeah, all of that. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. That I miss.
Yes, those buñuelos. I know. The tortillas de harina, that's something that I miss the most because it's something so simple.
Mm-hmm.
But when you do it right, and I'm from Ciudad Juarez, mm-hmm. so tortillas de harina. And every time I go back to New Mexico, it's the first thing I get.
Mm-hmm.
But speaking of Los Mochis, why don't you tell us a little bit about you growing up and how you end up in LA and a little bit about your career, and just so we can get a little bit of an introduction of your life before we start talking about your art.
But before we do that, we have to take a little break. Today's episode is brought to you by the original Lindo Michoacán.
The one
on East Desert Inn.
Right. That's the right
one. In Las Vegas. Why do you keep interrupting me?
Que no se les olvide.
I don't understand why you keep interrupting me.
Keep going.
I want to talk about Lindo Michoacán, but you just keep talking.
You're in fast forward.
It's like my favorite restaurant.
Stupid. What do you like?
What the fuck, dude?
What do you like?
No respect.
What,
I have no respect.
What do you like from Lindo Michoacán?
No respect for Michoacán. No respect for Mexico, huh?
What do you like from Lindo Michoacán the most?
Oh, really? You know, I'm a chips and salsa kind of girl. I love chips and salsa. And como los chips y salsa de Lindo Michoacán, no hay dos. Okay?
Ay, cálmate, Duvalín. You know what I like? I like it's the red chile, the chile colorado.
Yes, girl.
There's something, you know, like growing up in the north and having burritos from Juarez, which is like poquitos frijoles in a stew, it's something that I miss a lot. And there's all those stews in the menu of Lindo Michoacán, chile verde, chile colorado. Ya sabes que si le pones puerco, I'm happy.
Ya tú sabes. And so if you are a Latinos Who Lunch listener and you say that you listen to Latinos Who Lunch, you get a 25% discount at Lindo Michoacán, the original on East Desert Inn. Isn't that amazing?
It's amazing. Y no se les olvide preguntar por su discount. Y cuando se los den, tip your waiter right.
Uh-huh. Also, I also recommend the carnitas. Even though I don't eat meat as much anymore, every time I go there, I suggest to my friends, Las carnitas a la Coca-Cola are the best, and they simply are, y'all. They are delicious, okay?
Mm-mm-mm.
Lindo Michoacán. Save water.
Drink margaritas.
And we're back. Yes. Okay. Thank you, Pablito, for setting that up right before the break. What a cliffhanger. This is like real radio. Alma, please tell us about your life.
Gladly. I love talking about myself.
Yes. Oh, me too. Yeah, that's why we're artists.
Yay. I can talk about myself for hours. So if you guys have, you know, want to do a whole series.
Oh, yeah.
Podcast,
this is, let's do it.
Yo. This is part one, everyone, of the Alma Lopez journey.
La novela.
Yes. Capítulo uno. Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so starting with capítulo uno, donde yo nací. Okay, so I was born in Los Mochis, Sinaloa, Mexico. Mm-hmm. I am the second daughter to my mom. I was born, according to my mom, during, she was really pregnant during an eclipse.
Oh,
and
wow.
So, yeah, it was a huge eclipse. And so she, like, said she pinned all these reflective things on her belly so that I wouldn't get touched by the moon, right? And so that she told me that story when I was a kid to basically explain why. See this little index finger? See how mm-hmm. the nail is like a little rooftop?
Yeah, there's like a dent in it, or like a line in your nail.
Yeah, like it looks like a little rooftop if you go this way, right? If you,
yeah.
And so then, because I would ask her, Mom, ¿por qué tengo eso? What's up? And so it's obvious it's a birth defect, right? But the way she would explain, she says, Mija, es que te besó la luna.
Wow.
You know, isn't that beautiful?
That's beautiful.
My mom. And so, so then when I was born, actually, my mom went to the partera. Right, because they were like, she didn't go to the hospital or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And so she went to the partera early in the morning. She felt, I guess she had felt like there was, I was ready to come out. And so she walked, you know, a ways to the partera and then knocked on the partera's door. And the partera knew that I was going to be born. And so she sent her back. She says, Señora, regresese ahorita. Right now, you're going to have the baby on the road. And so, but in Spanish, all this right. was happening in Los Mochis, Sinaloa, and they speak Spanish there, right? And so then my mom, as soon as she opened the door, she looked like it was about to, the sun was about to come out, right? So it was daybreak. And so then she opened the door and she says she laid down and poof, I came out real quick, you know?
Wow.
She was ready.
No, this is so interesting because this iconography, this strong female iconography that you use in your work, like, goes back to your birth. That's amazing.
That's right. Yeah, all these things that my mom has told me. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. My mom is such a interesting person because I remember asking her, Mom, como, you know, how did you come up with my name? Right? Because my name is Alma Lorena. Mm-hmm. And so she says, oh, mija, es que cuando estaba embarazada contigo, I was in the mercado and I heard somebody yelling it in the street somewhere. I was like, oh, that's a good story, Mom. Yeah.
So you grew up in Los Mochis and then you came over here. How old were you?
I was probably almost four. Mm-hmm. I was between 3 and 4 when my stepfather, who was working here, you know, brought my mom and my siblings and I to Los Angeles. Mm. So, and we lived all over Los Angeles, like seriously all over Los Angeles, like Compton, Pico Union near Convention Center. Northeast LA is kind of like where we settled, like El Sereno, where Cal State LA is. Mm-hmm. But then I've lived in Santa Monica and in, you know, pretty much everywhere all over Los Angeles. So
what attracted you later in life, or I don't know if it was earlier, about art? When did you decide that this is what you wanted to do? Because it seemed like it's been part of your... I mean, thinking about your mom and those stories, it seems like it's something that you've been thinking about or you're developing for a long time.
Yeah, since I was a kid, you know, and I think what's really interesting now that we're talking is that my work really is about storytelling, mm. right? And so I think that it comes from right? Those stories of my mom telling me this and that. You know, sometimes they sound like chisme, but they're really stories. And so I think I've always been interested in stories and storytelling. Mm-hmm. And I think that at some point I was also really interested in visually storytelling, right? Mm-hmm. Doing visual storytelling. And so since I was a kid, I remember drawing with Crayolas and that kind of thing. And in high school, I remember being part of groups that would, like classes, basically. I would take classes that were having to do with painting and drawing and that kind of stuff. And then when I went to UC Santa Barbara, where mm-hmm. I did my undergrad, I didn't want to do art. I mean, I wanted to do art because I liked it. And mm-hmm. so I would take art classes and stuff like that. But I would think, okay, I'm now at a university, and I was the first, you know, I'm a first generation.
Oh, that immigrant right. voice.
Yeah.
I'm going to go to school to be an artist.
What's up?
What? Like, my mama didn't cross the border for this.
Right? So, I mean, a lot of us have that. Like, we want to do something useful, right? And mm-hmm. useful is like law, so we can help our family, you know, get out of trouble.
Para los tickets.
Yeah. Medicine, so we can help heal somehow, right?
Shout out to my primo.
Yeah. And so, but I just wanted to do art. And and I tried different things as, you know, my freshman year at UC Santa Barbara, but I kept going back to like figure drawing and to painting and to that kind of stuff. And I remember my, the spring quarter of my freshman year being really frustrated with myself and thinking, I guess that's, I'm just going to do art. Like, I was like, oh, I guess I'm just going to do art, you know? And so then I remember having a conversation with my mom. And my mom was an orphan in Mexico. She was orphaned when she was 8 years old. And so she actually never had the opportunity to really study and go to school. But she always encouraged us, right, all of us, to go to school and to do well and all of that stuff. And so she... But I don't think she, you know, like a lot of us with who are first generation, I don't think she quite understood what school right. was about, right? Mm-hmm. And so I remember trying to talk to her about stuff that I was learning. And she would always look at me like, you're so weird, you know? But she would say, mija es rara, you know? Which is really interesting because rara literally means queer, mm-hmm. you know? I was just like, oh my God, my mama knew all the time. And so then... I remember having a conversation with her spring of my freshman year and telling her, Mom, you know I should do something useful, you know, like AKA not art. I said, but this is what I want to do. And I remember my mom looking at me like I was her hija rara, right? And so she looked at me and she says, mija, she says, esta es tu vida. Haz lo que te haga feliz. Pero recuerda that you have to take care of yourself. Well, she actually said it all in Spanish, right? So she said, mija, this is your life. So this is your life, and you need to do whatever makes you happy. But remember that you need to take care of yourself mm-hmm. financially.
No pressure.
No pressure, Mom. And so I remember thinking, I don't know, like my mind was blown at that point. Mm-hmm. And I was thinking, that's right, this is my life. Not like I didn't know that before for some reason, but her just saying it was really kind of mind-blowing. And I said, that's right, this is my life. And I do need to take care of myself. And therefore, I'm going to do art, you know? And so then I decided to do that. And I thought, you know, I'll figure it out, how to pay the rent and pay the bills. And
yeah, I recently read that a lot of the reason why graduates of color really don't advance as much as other students is because they have that on their shoulder. They have this family history, like, I'm the first one to go to college, and I need to take care of my family. So then they end up supporting their family and then not moving as far as, like, their white counterparts, right? Because a lot of those people already went to college, you know? So I think that's really interesting because I've been thinking about that a lot right now because one of my big goals is, like, oh, I want to buy my mom a house, like... If I buy her house, she'll stop bothering me about what the hell I'm doing with my life. She can't say shit if I buy her a house. But that's exactly on me, right? Like a lot of times we as artists or as people that have gone through university, we end up supporting the families that, as part of the American narrative, should be supporting us, right? As like 20-somethings, but that's not real life.
Yeah, it doesn't happen anymore, yeah. Shout out to UCLA. They actually just have a new journal, a Latinx journal of art. And in the following volume, it's all about that. It's all about POC numbers in Latinx studies. And it is amazing. I was able to read some of the essays before it comes out. And the numbers of the people that actually go to school and decided to do art and art history, they're low. But we have all these different obstacles in a way, because once we decide to go to for art, sometimes we have to drop because we have to take care of ourselves, because we have to take care of our families. So the numbers of people that actually make it through in our communities, it's in a way, it's getting lower and lower for those same reasons.
Mm-hmm. I think that that journal is the journal that is being edited by Professor Charlene Villaseñor Black.
Yes.
She's awesome. Shout out to her.
She's amazing. Yeah. They invited me for the next volume. And yeah. I talked about how I'm pretty much one of the few art historians practicing colonial Mexican art, that it's Mexican. And for mm-hmm. that reason, they wanted to hear those voices. Yeah, and shout out to her, because they're highlighting that, because we need more icons. We need more people that actually can be useful for the kids, because brown kids seeing other brown professors is very important, and academia doesn't understand that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, shout out to them.
Yeah, totally. I mean, she's one of the very few Chicana art historians, and super supportive at UCLA of students doing, you know, art. And so she's pretty fabulous. I really love her.
So go ahead.
So you were UC Santa Barbara, mm-hmm. and then you went to UC Irvine for your MFA, right?
Mm-hmm.
And now you're a professor at UCLA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm a professor. I'm an assistant professor in residence.
For Chicano studies?
In Chicano studies.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So in grad school, how do you came about your medium? Because you do a lot of digital printing. You also, you were telling me a little bit about how you did oil painting. So how you came about these iconic images that we all are familiar with?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, what's really interesting is, because, right, you went to also art school, mm-hmm. did you? And, mm-hmm. of course, you studied art, mm-hmm. right? So a lot of the art that we study is what?
White.
Western, white, right?
White.
White art, right? And so that's what I was studying, you know, as an undergrad. And as an undergrad, I would do some work and my professors would not quite get it, you know? And so most of the time I felt like I was kind of explaining things to them about what I was doing. And then even in grad school, I felt, I mean, it was a little slightly different because it was already the 90s, the multicultural 90s when I did my grad school work. And I was doing stuff on murals and installation and a whole range of things. I think I was trying to figure out where to go. It wasn't really until after grad school that I just kind of mm-hmm. sat myself down and meditated, like literally sat down. I used to have this rocking chair that I got from a thrift store somewhere. And I would sit there and I would just meditate on what is it that I really want to do. That's when most of my work that I do now, that's when it really started, after, you know, getting all the basics of that Western white education.
And that is a real problem. We actually talked about, rest in peace, Ed Fuentes. That's one of the things that we talked about in his episode, that him going back to school and making murals, the focus of his career, was a battle. He had to explain that this hierarchies of low art, high art, folk art, et cetera, do not work to explain the works and the murals of art communities. So it's always a fight, especially with this white institutions that forget that the trajectory of art in Latin America, it's so different than in the United States, and it's so different than in Europe, and it's so different than Asia and Africa, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But we have this dominant Western European voices that do not allow for this to actually develop more often, to have more kids doing this type of art.
Mm-hmm. And despite all that, right, there are many of us who still persist.
Exactly.
Right, and who still survive these systems and this kind of training, and who are doing incredible work, right? Amazing work that many of us admire, right? And people like, you know, some of the prints that you saw in my living room of people who I really love are artist Irena Cervantes, you know, who does these beautiful silkscreen prints and watercolor that doesn't look like watercolor. It's pretty, she's very avant-garde in that way. and then Diane Gamboa, right, who does these amazing paintings and prints that are kind of very S&M kind of stuff. And, right, so despite all that, we still survive and we still persist and we still excel and do some really amazing work. We do the work that is important to us, and so...
Yeah, and so I love that you do, you pretty much work in all these mediums and, you know, from painting to mixed media, photography, digital work, and murals. And I kind of want to touch on that a little bit because, you know, a few years ago, maybe last year actually, it was, I don't know, this time is...
You're like, when what was yesterday? You
know? When that Tiki Torch rally happened, you know, and when that Lowe's commercial happened and, you know, all these white supremacist sculptures, statues all over the country are being taken down. Yeah. It really, that actually really did have a big effect on me because I never really thought about that before because it's just so ingrained in Americana. Like, yeah, Confederate soldiers, they're our heroes. Like, that's wild, right, to think about that. That got me thinking about muralists, and specifically Chicano muralists, Chicana muralists, because murals are our monuments.
Correct.
And they, you know, that's kind of like what we're allowed to have. And, of course, as Latinos, we make the best out of it, right? We do murals all the way, right? So I kind of want to talk about that a little bit with you. What do you think about that? And maybe talk about some of your mural projects.
Yeah, you know, I'm, of course, you know, as an artist, I'm like, I can kind of see both sides, like those sculptures, like there's actual artists who did that. But then there are also like fucked up, you know, things that that we should really question and figure out. And do they need to be in those spaces, especially if people are becoming aware of that, you know, that kind of history and how, what they stand for and what and how they were done afterwards, right? It wasn't that they were done in the moment. They were done later, right?
Yeah.
And installed later to make a point.
Yeah, if you look at the footage of a lot of the bronze sculptures, they're like done really, they were done really quick and multiples of like so many like Robert E. Lee sculptures to put in all these squares across the South as a response to the civil rights movement, to remind people, you know, to like remind people kind of who's still in charge. Mm-hmm. So yeah, a lot of those sculptures didn't go up until the 50s, 60s, even into the 70s.
And they were very financed by very specific groups.
Exactly.
Right?
Yes.
So they were put in there very specifically with that specific kind of financing, like this is what we're going to do. Yeah. Whereas with murals, most of the time the financing is very like little and you know, people are, you know, the people who paint them barely have enough for like paint. Most of it is like
volunteer
work, and that's why then there and not just volunteer work, their own work, but bringing in community, right? To have community feel like they can participate in it and all that kind of stuff. So it's like a completely different project. I'm actually so happy to know that some of those murals, that the early murals, like in the 70s, are still around. And some of the places here in Los Angeles that are very famous for those historical murals are like in Boyle Heights, right? In Estrada Courts, which was, which had its very also turbulent history because it was a neighborhood, like in a lot of neighborhoods here in LA that were Latino, were knocked down, like, right? The, like the Dodger Stadium area. And then there was new construction. And so there was new construction. There were basically military barracks, right? And then for the people who were coming back from the military and then eventually became housing. And then in the 70s, you know, artists then said, well, this is our community. We should be able to do murals about our community. And so there were activists like this guy, Felix Gato. I can't remember his last name, but, you know, and so he started basically gathering monies to get paint, to get people to paint. And so some of the people who painted those murals are now some of the most famous artists, right? Like Isla Streetscapers,
yeah.
Judith Hernandez, Carlos Almaraz, Gronk, right? Some of those like really iconic, amazing artists, and their murals from the 70s have still survived, you know, in places like Estrada Courts, but also in places like in San Francisco and in San Diego and in Chicago, right? Yeah. Like beyond here, you know, just California. And so it's really great to see that. I'm actually really happy to have participated in murals. And the way that I started was I was working as a public arts administrator for a nonprofit organization called SPARC, Social and Public Art Resource Center. And so I would coordinate murals and I would hire interns to work with the artist all over Los Angeles. And then while I was doing that work, I met my collaborator friend, Noni Olabisi. And we met around the 92 uprising. Like, she was working on her first mural and she was having just a difficult time because she was living through the uprising. She was living through the Rodney King, you know, uprising. Right. And so she and I would have these really intense conversations about our communities. Because while the Rodney King trials were going on and then the uprising and the aftermath of the uprising, there were communities that were pitted against each other. Mm-hmm. And those communities were the ones that were living together, right? Which is the Black and Brown community. And so, you know, funding for reconstruction projects and things like that, there, you know, it was like crumbs that were being thrown at community. And so then there was this, who's going to get this? Is it going to be Brown community, Black community, what, you know? Mm-hmm. Black community moving out of like certain parts of South LA and Brown community moving in. So there was a lot of conflict. And so she and I would have these intense conversations about our communities and how really we have more in common than we have differences.
Right.
Right. That our histories in the U.S., right, the histories, you know, in terms of like education, right, in terms of like prisons, in terms of like all kinds of stuff, where we live, the things that we share, we have a lot more in common than what is usually highlighted, which are the differences. And so we applied for a commission through the City of Los Angeles Cultural Affairs to work on a mural in a library in South LA, and a tiny little old California style library. Mm-hmm. And the library actually in that little neighborhood came about how some libraries would happen, which is basically not that somebody said, oh, let's build a magnificent library in this Black community, right? It was more like the community itself said, we need books for our community and for our kids. And so then a community member would start a lending library in like the local store. Right. And then those holdings would become kind of too large to manage by the volunteers and the local store. And so then eventually, you know, a library would be built in the community. And so this library, the Angeles Mesa Library, was built in South LA. And kitty corner from this library was an elementary school. So Noni and I got together and we said, well, what's the most important thing in our communities? Right. And also, you know, being aware that the kitty corner to this library is a school and that most of the kids would come after school and study in this library. And so we said, well, education, of course. And an important thing historically in the U.S. is the segregation and desegregation of schools, right, for Black and Brown communities. And I had done another project with a friend where I had the opportunity to meet Felicitas Mendez, who was the mom of the kits that were named in the Mendes versus Westminster. Mm. Right? Do you guys know about that case? Mm-mm. Yeah, that was a really important, significant landmark case in Southern California where this family, the Mendes family, had moved from South L.A. during the time that the Japanese were being interned, mm-hmm. right? During World War II. And so, and they were being interned because they were Japanese, right?
Right.
And so, a family, a Japanese family, asked the Mendes family if they could please take care of their farm, right? Because most of the Japanese who were interned, or Japanese Americans, lost everything, right? They were interned for a few years and they came back and they had nothing ever. They've lost so much. So some families asked other families to, you know, take care of their stuff. So the Mendes took care of this farm in Westminster for this Japanese family that had been interned. And they tried to enroll their kids in school. They had three kids. And so they had Silvia Mendes, and then who was the eldest, and then two kids, two mm-hmm. boys. And so they, when they tried to enroll them in their local school, right, which is like the normal thing all parents do.
Mm-hmm. Basic civil right.
Basic stuff, right? Uh-huh. The school said, no, they're too dark. They cannot be. They have wow. to go to the Mexican school miles down the way. And so the father and the mom, right, Gonzalo and Felicitas Mendez, said, that's like not right. And so they tried to organize other parents. I think ultimately they ended up filing themselves here in L.A. And in 1945, and then in 1947, they won the case. And yes. fortunately, this, you know, Mendes versus Westminster was then, among other cases, was used for Brown versus mm-hmm. the Board of Education, right? Which is the one that, the case that desegregated schools in the U.S. Mm. in 1954. But wow. I know, but it's all these cases, right? And a really important, significant case was this Mendes case. And it was, the father was Chicano and the mom was Puerto Ricana, right? And their three kids, you know, later they had more kids. And they're all really great. And actually, Silvia accepted during the Obama administration the medal for her family.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so, you know, important cases that, I mean, do we hear about this history?
No.
No. I mean, I grew up here in Los Angeles, like LA Unified Miseducated, right? And and so I didn't hear about this history until I went and did my undergrad at UC Santa Barbara and read this one book where there was like a mention of Mendes versus Westminster. And I was just like, a mention? There should be like books, you know, written about
I was thinking about that because when you mentioned the uprisings, the way that we learn about what happened in 1992, it's always riots. Mm-hmm. So language is so important, but also the way that history is constructed to us. Not only the way that history is constructed to us, but also the way that history is erased. That's why mural projects are so important, and mm-hmm. they should continue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like I've learned a lot of my education has been by looking at murals, mm-hmm. right? Growing up with murals. And then later doing murals. And so Noni and I then, you know, focused our project on the desegregation of schools in the U.S., you know, with both highlighting the Mendes and the Brown versus the Board of Education, as well as the hunger strikes that were going on at UCLA in the 90s.
And I might be wrong, but was that mural recently erased or
no
or still
no no no
up?
Let me show you I'll show you the indoor mural, and it's painted on canvas, and it's wrapped in on this fireplace of the this little library, right? And it's the LA Public Library, and so it's this is the mural. So unfortunately I don't have a bigger picture on it right here, but this is this is the Mendes family. This is Silvia and her brothers and Felicitas and Gonzalo, who we had the opportunity to meet. And then this is a depiction of the Brown case. And then these are kind of representing the UCLA hunger strikers, but also the walkouts, right? So it's like kind of historical image. And then here they're holding a banner, which is a flag of the stripes are supposed to be like strawberries and cotton. That's why they're red and white, which is the stripes of the flag. Mm-hmm. But they're like black and brown, you know, the farm workers who are picking this stuff and who are like the fabric, right, of this place. And then in here is education is a basic human right, which is one of the statutes of the human rights of the child, which is getting, you know, that all children have the right to an education.
That's fascinating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so looking at the photo, we're probably going to put it on Instagram so everybody can see when the episode comes out. But it's a pretty big mural. It's like probably at least 30 feet tall from the looks of it. And yeah, I love that you can see the history within the mural. There's figures that are in black and white, figures that are in color. So you kind of see the different movements in there. I really like that part about it. And it's in a library, so I like that you put a book at the bottom there, like, yo, this is our history.
This is where you can hopefully find it, or where we will be writing it, right? And so,
yeah,
in front is like, we, you know, Noni and I would sometimes do tours of the murals and the mural projects. And so to kind of let people know, you know, that this project is there in their community and that we are in the community. We were both, she still lives in that community. You know, I've moved out. We used to live in the same apartment building when we worked on this project. And so, yeah, I mean, it was important to us to show that the commonalities, right? Because like you said, right? Like, right. It's like the pitting, and even with language, right? It's like, it's a riot. It's like, oh, you know, riot sounds kind of punk, but, but it also, it sounds like the people themselves are being violent, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas in more often than not, they're just defending themselves or just trying to, like, you know, defend themselves. Like, for instance, a suit, right? They say suit riots.
It's supposed to uprising. But
revolution.
Or getting
protest.
Or getting beat up by military people. Oh my goodness. That's
that's the government. Hide.
Yeah, it's like some flash emergency floods alert.
Or yeah. Yeah. And but part of the reason is because when they're deemed uprisings, you highlight the failure of the system. So in order to hide that failure, you give the fault to the brown, the POC communities. Mm-hmm. And that has been happening in history for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Pinning the people of color against each other, is like white supremacy's like biggest move every time.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. So Alma, it's not only a badass artist, but she's also an author. I know in 2011, UT Press, you published Our Lady of Controversy. Mm-hmm. We have to talk about it at least for a little bit.
Let's get into it.
Tell us a little bit about the book and the reason behind the book, because it's one of the things that a lot of people want to know a little bit more about.
Okay, if they want to know more about, I invite them to go to my website, almalopez.com. There's a whole section on Our Lady where I have like, I don't know, like 1,000 emails that accumulated during the protests that we're going to talk about. Mm-hmm. And then also quite a few news articles. I tried to collect as much as possible, but I have to admit that I didn't collect everything,
right?
Just because of the madness of what was going on. So the Our Lady of Controversy, the editors at UT Press, who were, they had this special kind of editorial group called Chicana Matters. Mm-hmm. And it was edited by Antonia Castaneda and Dina Gonzalez. And they did some amazing work of having Chicanas published, right? In order to, right? Because as we weren't teaching, right? You have to get published in order to then secure like your tenure track job.
Going through it right now.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. So they, both Dina and Antonia saw that this was an important thing. So they pitched it to UT Austin. And so then they, early on when the country was going on, both of them were like, you need to write about this.
Yes.
And I was like, I'm an artist. What do I know about writing? But, you know, I am a storyteller too. So I wanted to tell the story. So what happened was that the book is, you know, published by UT Press in 2018. It's titled Our Lady of Controversy, Alma Lopez's Irreverent, in quotations, apparition. Uh-huh. And it was edited by my spouse, Alicia Gaspar de Alba, who's a pretty fabulous writer, and myself. And we asked, you know, some really important people to write about the controversy from their own perspective. And these are pretty amazing writers, people like Emma Perez, right, who wrote the Decolonial Imaginary. Dina Gonzalez, who's from New Mexico and also a published writer and editor. And Tay Mariana Nunn, who's the curator, right, writing from her perspective on the controversy. And quite a few other people. So I think it's a fabulous book.
Compilation, yes. Yeah.
And the whole kind of purpose of the book, I think it would have been really easy to be, to kind of put down, you know, New Mexico and to be saying, oh, you guys just totally don't get it, right? But we didn't want to do that. We wanted to really try to tackle this historical moment in from different perspectives and try to understand it, you know, and try to be also sensitive, you know, and to understand it basically. And so I write an essay in there where I talk about the making of the image Our Lady and then my participation in the exhibition. And then I also put together a video because I knew that just like I am part of a tradition, right, in terms of like public art and murals in the Chicano community, I am also part of a tradition of Chicana feminists who have done revisionist work on the Virgen de Guadalupe. And I knew that I wasn't the only one. And so I was really surprised when people in New Mexico and other places were mad at me for
escandalizados,
everybody, you know, for the image that I had done when I was just like, yo, you know, like, Esther Hernandez did a karate virgen in, right, in the, like, 70s. And Yolanda Lopez did a whole series of like, they were actually, like, drawings, pastel and drawings and stuff like that, of the Virgen de Guadalupe in 76. And so I was just like, no, it's 76 and 78. And so I was just like, why are you all scandalized? And so, but I wanted to give credit where I felt credit was due, which is really to acknowledge Hernandez and Lopez for their feminist revolutionary work on the Virgen de Guadalupe and to let people know, like, yo, don't blame me, blame them, right?
Yeah, like, I'm not in a bubble. Like, I'm part of a context. Can you describe just really fast the image for us?
Sure. Mm-hmm. So the image, I was actually working on the image after graduate school. Like, you know, like I was saying this earlier, that the most important work that I've done has been after, right, being trained as an artist in UCs. And so I was living in South LA, right, working on the mural of education as a basic human right and sitting there and thinking about, you know, what am I going to do with my life as an artist, you know? And so then there were these news reports that the Virgen de Guadalupe had been in different stores had been vandalized, which was totally weird, right? That's never happened before.
They were like defacing murals and stuff, right?
Yeah, yeah. Of the Virgen de Guadalupe, which is really weird. But you know, it's understood because basically there was a shift in community. There were people who were no longer Catholic, but they were like Pentecostal Christians. So there was a whole shift in religion.
Oh, yeah. Right? Those people, so, do y'all they remember? Do not like the media.
Yeah.
That's my background. They think she's a false idol.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
she's an American idol, damn it. Very,
She's the OG American Idol.
The original.
Yeah. So she, so anyway, there were this stuff going on. And so then I thought, oh, let me do something about that, you know? And so I asked some friends and we would have conversations about, right? Like we all have, we may not be all Latinos who lunch, but we all sit around and talk about stuff. And so I would have conversations with the models, Raquel Salinas, who's a performance artist, Raquel Gutierrez, who's also a performance artist. And so we would have conversations about growing up with the Virgen. And, you know, we all had some stories of commonality of, you know, like, oh, our parents expected us to be like the Virgen, but yet they didn't expect our brothers to be like Jesus, you know, and stuff like that, right? And so, or growing up, going to Catholic school, I went public school all the way, baby, but, you know, some of them went to Catholic school. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, we had all those kinds of things. So I thought, let me do an image that talks about these things, you know?
Yeah.
And at the same time, I happened to be reading this edited volume by Ana Castillo, where there was an essay in there by Sandra Cisneros, Guadalupe the Sex Goddess. And so I remember reading that short little essay. Have y'all read it?
Mm-mm.
It's a little must read, you know, because
she's wondrous. Like, I remember the part where she's like, wonders what's under the robe,
right? Yeah. You know, don't we all wonder what's underneath people's clothes?
Absolutely.
So she's really trying to make a connection, you know, she's trying to really connect to the Virgen de Guadalupe. Like, is she somebody I can believe in? Like, Juan Diego believed in her, right? And so then at the end, she asked, like, you know, I wonder what she would be wearing if I lifted her dress. And then I was just like, oh my God, I totally know.
Gold.
I totally know. So, and it was roses, you know? I thought roses, because that's the proof of the Virgen's apparition.
Las Rosas de Castilla, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so then that's what the image I wanted to do. I wanted to dress, right, my model in roses and blow up the whole outfit. Mm-hmm. So in the background, there is the dress, right, and the robe and the flowers and all that. And then the model standing in the center is a really strong Chicana who's in a power pose, right? And she's dressed in roses. So a power pose is kind of like the Wonder Woman pose, you know, right? With the hands on the hips. But it's also like the pose of, like, I remember my mom and my aunts when they were like, if you don't behave, te voy a tirar la chancla, you know, that kind of thing. And so, so kind of like that. And I think that part of the controversy was that attitude, you know, that sassiness from, you know, that people just didn't like that, you know. It's like the Virgen de Guadalupe is supposed to be like so
comforting,
like,
nurturing. It's supposed to confronting, yes.
Yeah, uh-huh. And so I'm like, well, you know what? Our mothers can be nurturing, but they can also kick ass, you know? And so therefore, there's space for all that. But some people just freaked out, you know, and some people... In the video that I did, there were people interviewed who were just like, oh my God, this is not my mother. And I'm like, yo, Raquel Salinas is of course not your mama, you know? It's like, go visit your mama. Obviously, you don't remember what your mama looks like, you know? And so I did this image in 99 as part of this whole digital project that I was working on. Mm-hmm. And I showed it around. I even showed it in Juarez. Right. I even received like a grant. There was this whole Pollock Siqueiros grant in Juarez. Uh-huh.
And people, Museo de Limba or?
Yeah. And people loved it, you know. And so, and all the, like the Lupe and Sirena and all that stuff. People love that work. Uh-huh. And so, but then while I was there, actually getting that award, I met Tay Mariana Nunn's mom. Right, wow. Tay Diana Rebolledo.
Yeah.
Right, and Tay Diana Rebolledo said, oh, you know, my daughter is working on this cyber exhibition, and this work would probably fit. She said, do you have slides? I know some of you don't know what slides are.
But I remember.
You remember?
Yeah.
So slides were like, that's how us artists trafficked our work, right? Uh-huh. So it was like basically 35 millimeter
transparencies
uh-huh. that's how, you know, before Prezi or PowerPoint or anything like that, that's how we showed our work. And so I happened to have made like a whole sheet of those images. And I said, sure, here, you know. And I gave them to Tay Diana Rebolledo. And so from now on, then on, it's like this debate between Sandra Cisneros and Tay Diana Rebolledo, like who started the controversy, right?
Because they want to take credit.
Yeah, Sandra Cisneros says, well, it was my essay. And then Tay Diana says, well, it was me who asked for the slides, you know, and sent and, you know, trafficked them across the border to, you know, New Mexico. Tay Mariana Nunn, who was doing this amazing exhibition. I mean, amazing exhibition for that time.
In Santa
Fe, New Mexico. Yeah, in the museums, where she basically wanted to create a bridge between people who knew the traditional imagery of al culturas, right? And people, maybe younger people who knew the technology, right? And so then the exhibition was cyber arte, where technology meets tradition. And so basically... you know, introducing perhaps, you know, a whole generation to digital work, and then introducing maybe a younger generation who knew the technology to like these cultural images, right? Uh-huh. Which is like amazing.
Right.
I thought genius exhibition.
Little did you know.
And little did I know. And so she selected four of us. I was the only foreigner because I was like the only one from California, right? The other three were from New Mexico, and they were great artists too. Mary Martinez, who does this amazing work where she collects basically old, televisions and things like that and recycles them into this fabulous art. Elena Baca, who does digital prints.
Oh,
Elena?
Her. Yeah. She's amazing. Yeah.
She's incredible, right? And then also Teresa Archuleta, who would do these weavings and digital prints. And so I was like the only Mexicana and also from California. And so when the exhibit went up and they distributed the flyers, there were these people from this local church, Guadalupe, something or other, who got really upset. And they were like, oh, no, this is not right. This is, who is this, you know? And so then I was just like, what, I'm Mexicana, you know? I'm from California. I grew up with this image. Yeah, I can, you know? I really can. And so, but they got really upset, and they were really well organized, which was pretty awesome in a way, you know? But they were just organized against me, which was not so
awesome.
That's
so great.
Yeah, and so they...
It looked scary from the footage that I saw when they had the big meeting at the museum.
It was really scary.
That's really... It looked really scary.
It was really scary. It's actually probably the scariest time that I've had. And I've, like, grew up in LA. I mean, first of all, I was born in Sinaloa, where, like, you know... The cartel and right?
All the corridos were written about.
Right? Oh, banda and corridos and all that. So I grew up, I was born there. And then I was raised in LA working, raised in all kinds of communities in LA, right? And then working in all kinds of communities, including Skid Row. So I'm not tough, right? And so, but being in New Mexico at that time was the scariest time. I knew that, you know, when you sense it, like if somebody can hurt me, they're gonna hurt me.
Right.
And so you know, I tried to avoid Santa Fe there for a little bit. stay away from the fire. And so they just got really upset. And I remember the kind of the first time I realized, oh, this is not good, was I was working at, you know, in a community center in East LA, and a friend called me and said, Alma, are you near television? Turn it to channel, I think it was like 52, which was Primer Impacto.
With Maria Celeste Herreras. She's my fave.
And
shout out to you, girl.
And so I was just like, oh, let me turn it on too. And then I started watching, and there were like all these señoras with velos and like praying against my image.
Scandala.
I know. And I was just like, okay, I'm in trouble.
But
now,
the wildest part to me was that 90% of the people that were protesting hadn't even seen the image.
Yeah.
It was just because the archbishop had them organized and told them about
Michael J. Sheehan,
who, I listened to one of his interviews, who thought he was like God's gift to Santa Fe. He was like,
todos los Santa Feos son iguales.
Yeah, he's like, I don't know what, he thought he was a mystical curandero, God's gift to the world. I was like,
oh my God.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. That was wild.
Those colonial legacies are real.
Well, yeah. And the thing is, you know, when this happened, I had to call my mom right away because my mom is a big Primer Impacto person, right? I was just like, oh my God, I'm in trouble now with my mama. So I called her up and she was like, mija, I think I saw something
in national TV.
I know, I've been reading back though, like her favorite show, you know. And so I was just like, see, you know, I had to play it down, like, oh, see, mom.
¿Qué dijo Walter Mercado?
Yeah. And so, but my mom was so awesome because my mom was just like, mija, ¿qué están protestando? Una obrita de arte. Because she, you know, she's like, been around my work,
she
right?
She gets it.
And so she was just like, deberían de protestar a esos, you know, malditos sacerdotes y personas que han estado haciendo tantos males a la comunidad. Esos son los que deben de protestar, no un museo. I was just like, usted tiene mucha razón, mamá. You know, of course.
You're all happy that she's not mad. You're like, oh, good.
Yeah, I was just like, oh, my God.
Good.
But then, the people, like you said, right, they hadn't even seen the image. And so they were protesting the image because they were being asked to protest it. And so later I had, you know, when I was talking about the work and stuff like that, I would have people email me and say, oh, you know, I went like a student from Colorado, right, would go to New Mexico to visit her parents during that controversy and went to church and everything and said, you know, I was in church with my parents and they were being asked to protest this image. And so she said, you know, this young student said, I asked my parents, well, have you gone to the museum to see it? And her parents were like, pues no, no vamos a ir, you know? And she was like, well, how can you protest something if you haven't seen it?
Right.
So people hadn't seen it. And even here in East LA, like a friend approached me and said, oh, my mom's so mad at you. I was just like, yo, I don't even know your mama. And so he was like, yeah, she's so mad at you because you did the Virgen Biche, right? Biche, which means nude. Uh-huh. And so I was just like, she's not
Has
nude.
Has she seen it?
No, she had heard in her, like, when she was doing her hair at her cosmetología, whatever.
It was on the TV. The yeah.
And so she had her, you know, the gossip, right? And so and I said, you know, no está biche. She's wearing roses. Right. She's, like, wearing a lot more than J-Lo, you know, was wearing. And so I gave him a postcard and dedicated to his mom. I said, you know, señora, no estoy enojada conmigo. La Virgen no está biche. Yo no soy así, persona tan... respeto.
I live on agüita de Jamaica. Para que se conteste.
Yeah, so you don't get so mad at me. So then, but that's what it was. People hadn't seen the image and were upset with me and stuff like that.
What's the title of the image?
That's a good question. Mm-hmm. It's titled Our Lady.
Right. And you know how I learned about it?
Huh.
The Bikini Guadalupe.
Oh, huh.
That's how I learned first about it.
Yeah.
Which goes back to what we're saying about language. So when you manipulate those things and those stories and what happens behind it, it becomes something completely different than your intentions as an artist.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, the biggest thing that I have to say about that image is that, especially since you were talking about Michael J. Sheehan, right? The Archbishop and all that stuff. The main kind of leaders of the protests were people in the church. The Archbishop of Santa Fe, New Mexico, Michael J. Sheehan. Later, when I was showing it in Ireland in a Chicano studies conference, it was like one of the main church people there. I forget what they call them. And then later when I showed it in Oakland Museum, the bishop from Oakland Museum, right? So it's all these like main people. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that they have in common, these people, is that they're white men, right? Because in those positions of power in the Catholic Church, women are not even in those positions of power, right? It's only these white men.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is that my whole theory about the Virgen de Guadalupe is that the church has stolen her from us.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. The church has stolen. So a lot of us learn about the Virgen de Guadalupe, you know, not just from our grandmas and parents and aunts, but because we see her in church. Right. And so the church itself, the Catholic Church, has stolen her from us. And then they then organize and support these protests so that we cannot relate to her in a way that is significant and important to us and really personal, right?
And what is fascinating about that is that, and we talked about it because we did a whole episode on La Virgen de Guadalupe, is that the church protested that image in the 1500s. They didn't want that. There were sermons, public sermons, condemning an image that was created by an indigenous artist. So you're absolutely right. Mm-hmm. The church has taken that image from us.
Yeah. For me, right, growing up with the image, I mean, of course, I grew up with her, seeing her in my home in Los Angeles and in Mexico and in my community, right? And so I related it to her in those ways, you know, that she is my image, you know, that I'm growing up with, and that there's certain expectations, like family and cultural expectations of me and this image, right, as a girl. But also that later when I was taking Chicana and Chicano studies courses, what I saw is that this image was a revolutionary image more than anything, right? Mm-hmm. Because during the Revolución, the Independencia of Mexico, right? Father Hidalgo, that is the bandera, right? That he takes, the Virgen de Guadalupe
from
bandera.
From Totonilco el Grande, yes, in Guanajuato,
right? And then later during the revolution, right, with Zapata and Villa, right? In the 1910, right, the early 1900s, they also walk in to all these different pueblos carrying the estandarte, the Virgen de Guadalupe, right?
It's her flag.
It's the flag, right? And then what happens here in the U.S. with Cesar Chavez and the United Farm Workers, right? The beginning of the Chicano movement, they carry her too, right? So for me, and then with Esther and Yolanda, you know, during the feminist 70s Chicana revolution, right? And so I was just like, I always saw her as, this is a revolutionary image.
It is.
Right? But then one of the good things actually about the controversy, it really made me stop versus like, it's like, okay, I did this work, I'm going to move on, right? It made me actually stop and really think about what this image meant for me and then study her. And so then that's where I learned like, oh my God, this church stole her from us, right? Because the Virgen de Guadalupe, like you were saying, right? The Virgen de Guadalupe is really an indigenous image. The indigenous people, when she appeared, according to the legend, in 1531, it had been 10 years after the conquest of Mexico.
Right.
It had been like a massacre, a genocide of the indigenous populations in Mexico, what we know now as Mexico, right? And so people were at a point of extinction. Like we would not exist if some of those indigenous people did not exist.
Correct.
Right? Like, so what I'm imagining that happened is that in 1531 or whenever it was a community, you know, maybe indigenous who lunch, right? who got together and said, we're at a point of extinction, people. Yo, you know, we got to organize and we got to send out a message to our comunidad and let them know that they need to wise up. And so at that point, there was is genocide, right? People were not converting. After the Virgen appears in 1531, then the people convert peacefully, the indigenous people, right? There's millions of conversions. But they're not converting to Catholic. They're converting to this indigenous image, right?
To this middle point, yes.
Yeah, and so they know, you know, like there's all these debates of like, well, the indigenous people couldn't have created this image because they didn't know, right? But yo, who was building the churches?
Right.
Who was making the paintings in these churches, right? Uh-huh. It was the indigenous people. So all the indigenous people knew how to paint like Leonardo da Vinci.
Right.
You know, they knew the styles.
I just had a conversation with my tío who, like, believes in aliens, you know? And he's like, what? Because I just went to Guatemala. And he's like, oh, you went to Tikal? What do you think? I heard the aliens built it. And I was like, tío, I almost called him girl. I was like, you know, the Mayas knew math. Like, they built the pyramids.
Have you heard of the zero?
Have you heard of it?
Yeah.
But it's like all this stuff, like, how could that have happened? Mm-hmm. How could they have built their own pyramids? It had to be aliens because only white people can build giant things, you know,
or green
I mean?
People
or exactly.
Like they're too tontos, you know, they're indígenas, son inditos, right? But what I imagine that really happened at this point was that the indigenous people says we're gonna die, you know, we're not gonna survive this genocide, and so we have to organize. And so there were artists who were organizing, there were, you know, teachers, there were parents, there were all these community people who said, we have to create an image to organize. But at that point, everything was being destroyed, right? So they were, all the codices were being burned. Even like big, beautiful sculptures were being buried because they were all being broken.
Destroyed.
Yeah.
When you say that, it reminds me of Diana Magaloni's scholarship. She writes about the Florentine Codex, which is this 30-volume book about the life of indigenous people in Mexico. And one of the things she talks about is how some pages are black and white because there's no people to make the pigments because they're being killed outside as this book is being created.
Yeah.
So it's so important. And that's what I love about your work, that when I show this image in class, it's not just about contemporary issues. We can talk about 500 years of history through one single image, and that's the power of art, and that's the power that we should foster in schools and everywhere else.
Yeah. And but you know what's the other trip is that the first person to write the Nican Mopua, which was basically here it is written, and to put the oral story 25 years after the apparition, was one of the people, the indigenous scribes for Sahagún, who was doing collecting
one of the tlaquilos.
And so he writes the story down for the first time it's ever written. He writes it down in the Florentine Codex. Or no, he doesn't write. I don't know if it's part of the Florentine Codex, but he writes it down. Mm-hmm. And it's called the Nican Mopua. And so he, I can't remember his name right now. So then he writes it, right? He was born in 1531, 25 years later, when he's 25, he writes the story, right? And that's the first time it is written, and is written in the Nahuatl language, right? When was it written in the official language, which was Spanish? Do you know? Yeah, it wasn't until like over 100 years after the apparition.
Right, in the 1640s, yes. Yeah. I read about it, like some of the first novels where you first have the apparition of Juan Diego wasn't until like 100 years later. And yeah. Prior to that, this the connection that the church wanted to make between indigenous people and the and La Virgen didn't exist. Mm-hmm. But then they realized that it was the local people that are pushing for the image. So now Juan Diego becomes this prominent figure, but it's not till the 1640s, 1650s.
Yeah, and so then when they write about it, it's actually a translation of the Nican Mopua written by, I can't remember his name. But anyway, then it's like you were saying, in 1666, there are these like Inquisition trials where the church itself, the Catholic Church in mm-hmm. Mexico, the Catedral, because La Virgen de Guadalupe is not even in the Catedral until much later, like a digital reproduction of her. She's like way out in the hills. So in 1666, there are all these trials that basically they bring in people who attest that she is miraculous, that they knew Juan Diego. But like Juan Diego was around in 1531. He died 1547. Like, there was nobody in 1666 who knew the guy, And that's what's so funny about the painting of the Juan Diego painting that was painted by Miguel Cabrera, mm-hmm. who also painted Sor Juana, right? Because he paints the Juan Diego, and he says the real retrato of Juan Diego, mm-hmm. but it's like written when it's painted when nobody is around who may have even known
1700s, like 200 years later, or something like that. Yeah,
and what's really funny, if you look at it closely, you just have to go and trust me, look at it closely, and Juan Diego looks a lot like Miguel Cabrera, so it's more like a self portrait, Yeah. Just like the Jesus that we see everywhere now, that looks a lot like Este da Vinci. Mm-hmm. So like that is Jesus, da Vinci.
And in like Gabriel Cabrera is advancing the cause. So he wants the viceroyalty to take in consideration that these people, that artists are more than just mm-hmm. people that paint. They're artists. So they insert themselves in these narratives. And then later, Miguel Cabrera writes Maravilla Americana, commissioned by the viceroyalty specifically for that. So mm-hmm. in a way, Miguel Cabrera sees himself as the new Juan Diego.
Yeah, he does. But you know what's really even more fascinating too, is when I was doing the research, the one of the things was the roses, right? They make a big deal of the roses.
The Castilla.
Yeah, that they couldn't have existed. But why not? Yeah. Somebody could have brought a rose and planted a bush like 10 years after the conquest, right? Mm-hmm. So that's one thing that was kind of weird. Plus, my mom, she grew roses, and all the señoras in our neighborhood grew roses, and like roses would blossom mm-hmm. around the time of the Virgen de Guadalupe, because what is it that we take to the Virgen de Guadalupe?
Rosas.
Like, and so that means December. They're blooming. Yeah. And the same time zone in Los Angeles, the same time zone in Mexico. But the other thing, I keep bumping this. The other thing that is really fascinating is that Juan de Zumárraga, right, who was the first Archbishop of Mexico, and who was in the story of the apparition of the Virgen de Guadalupe, the one whom Juan Diego reveals the image on his tilma after he drops the roses, right? When did he write, Zumárraga? Mm-hmm. When did he write about this story, this miraculous apparition?
He never did.
He never did. Which is like, if I had been witness to such an apparition or just to an awesome painting,
I would have made t-shirts out of it.
Yo, that's right.
I Recuerdos. I saw the Virgen here first.
You know what? I would have made little buttons and then gave them to everybody.
Made La Virgen de Guadalupe great again.
Yeah, that's right.
Shot glasses.
Yeah, sure. It would have been definitely in my website. And so, but he never wrote about it. And the thing is that according to his biographer, Icaz Balseta, Zumárraga was really prolific, It wasn't like he like was a slacker and never wrote anything.
No. He did a lot.
He wrote a lot of sermons, a lot of reports. He also brought the colegio to Mexico. He brought the printing press to Mexico. So even if he was
an inquisitor at some point.
Yeah. If he had no time because he was doing these inquisitions and no time to write, he could have asked somebody else.
The top of his head was always so cold. I think he forgot. Right?
He could have, you know, like she's so important that he could have given himself credit.
I know.
Right. You know? But yet he never writes about it. So guess what Icaz Balseta said? Like, but very kind of scared of what the repercussions were going to be.
I don't know.
He said, I don't think Zumárraga was there.
Oof.
That's not mind-blowing. Yeah, I was like, oh my God.
I mean, we're running out of time, but I wonder if it's the 18th century that all the Creoles are giving him all this credit that where he doesn't deserve it.
Well, listen, according to the 1990s PBS show Wishbone, where Juan Diego is played by a Jack Russell Terrier, he was definitely there.
Yeah, right?
It must be
so
true.
So facts are facts, America.
Alma, somebody lied to you several times.
Right. So what's up? So, yeah. So then that's why I always tell students, you know, when I'm telling this story, I'm like, you need to research this.
Yes.
We as a community need to like take her back from the church, right? Don't let these, you know, white old men think that they can claim her and tell us how to relate to the Virgen de Guadalupe.
That's exactly it. That's what I wanted to say. Like, the reason why all those men were angry is because you were using the Virgen to express yourself. And it wasn't used as a tool for the patriarchy or for white supremacy like it usually is.
Exactly.
And they didn't like that. They felt like they were being stepped on. And they had... It all boils down to toxic masculinity, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
What? No, this is our image to manipulate people. This is not correct. You know what I mean? So that was, I feel like that was the biggest issue for them.
That's a great lesson to end this episode with, because we always talk about how our narratives should be our narratives, and we need to control that. And we're always talking about not letting others to colonize our voices. So your art, your career, your trajectory, which is, it is iconic. It's a great example of that. And for that, we thank you so, so, so very much.
Oh, wow. Thank you so much. It's been so great meeting both of you and being able to have this chat.
I know. This morning. Thank you so much. And again, this is just capítulo uno. So we're going to have you back again. You're so much fun to talk to. You're a wealth of knowledge.
And just as a general, because we always have a section of recommendations, let's do your book, Our Lady of Controversy, which it was published, as you say, by UT Press in 2018. And
2011.
2011, yeah. Yes. So it is available in pretty much everywhere. So check it out. Look it up. It's a great collection of essays. And we'll put the link so you can purchase your book. And again, Alma, we cannot thank you enough. This is a dream come true for us. Thank you so, so, so much.
Yay, kisses.
Yeah.
And as always, you can visit our website, latinoswholunch.com. Please send your emails to asklwlpod@gmail.com. And if you have a moment, please leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts, 5 stars.
5 estrellas solamente.
Because the more reviews we have, the more visible we are.
And visibility leads to representation, and representation matters, people.
Today's guest was Alma Lopez. You could visit her website, www.almalopez.com, for everything Alma. The show is produced by Emmanuel Ortega and Justin Favela. Music by the band Brownout. I'm Favi Fav.
And I'm Babelito.
Bye.